Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Almost 6 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's disease, and that number is expected to more than double within the next 30 years. Most of what we know about the condition that affects part of the brain that controls thought, memory, and language has been learned in the last 30 years. Research and clinical trials are making new discoveries, too. The Alzheimer's Association's Trial Match program helps to match those living with Alzheimer's to clinical trials. All topics we'll discuss today with our guest, Dr. Keith Fargo, Director of Scientific Programs and Outreach at the Alzheimer's Association. Dr. Fargo, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Clay Jacobs, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association, the Greater Pennsylvania Chapter. Clay Jacobs, good to see you again.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
If you have a question or a comment, we know this is a topic that there always are a lot of questions about. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You also can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Clay Jacobs, I read those numbers, 5.8 million Americans living with Alzheimer's, and as I said, expected to double about 14 million by the year 2050. Give us a sense of why the number of people being diagnosed with Alzheimer's is increasing, and that sounds awful fast in 30 years.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great point to start because this disease can seem daunting. In Pennsylvania, there are 280,000 people diagnosed. We expect that to increase to 320,000 as our population actually grows older. But we also know even today, almost 700,000 caregivers are providing direct care. And so when we start talking about Alzheimer's disease and dementia, it is a disease that the numbers just begin to peak at the impact. It doesn't begin to highlight the personal, the emotional, the physical, the financial cost of this disease. And so we look at the numbers growing as our population ages, ideally as we become more accurate and more proactive in early detection and diagnosis. And so these conversations are important as well as taking action because there are far too many families who are doing the best they can but need additional support, access to resources, and so much more.
I notice whenever we speak or whenever I'm reading about the Alzheimer's Association and about the disease itself, that caregivers is right there at the very top of the mention, of being mentioned in the conversation. That would seem to really mean that it is very important for us as a society, not just those who have been diagnosed, but those families, those caregivers who are impacted by this.
Absolutely. So this is a progressive neurodegenerative and ultimately fatal disease. And so when someone's diagnosed, it is really a disease that impacts families and families of choice, whatever that may look like, because we serve as care partners. We're engaged in the planning and the care and support and all of those pieces. And quite frankly, as we look at needing to see improvements in detection and diagnosis, access to services, all of those things, is that it really does take a group of caregivers and care partners to deal as effectively with this disease as we can today. And we know that there are significant impact on those providing care. And so we must address both issues concurrently. And at the association, fundamentally, while we look at larger system change and working towards research and our vision of a world without Alzheimer's disease, we were started 40 years ago by those who were looking at lack of access to caregiver supports and services. And so that remains core to our mission as we also look to have broader and more significant impact on the disease.
You know, a word that is thrown around a lot today is the word crisis. From what you just described, are we in a crisis situation?
I think it's unquestionable that we absolutely are. You know, you mentioned that there are almost 6 million people in the U.S. with Alzheimer's today. It's going to go up to 14 million by the year 2050. Part of what's driving that actually is the changing demographic shape of our society. We are at an individual level living longer, and as you live longer, your risk for Alzheimer's disease does increase, although this is certainly not a normal part of aging. And on top of of that, we have the baby boom generation, which is also now entering the age of increased risk. The oldest baby boomers, rather, are now in their early 70s. And so we're going to see a large group of people now developing Alzheimer's disease in the coming years if we don't see any medical breakthroughs. Not only the numbers themselves speak to that, though, but the cost. Alzheimer's disease is actually the costliest disease in the United States to our society. This is the third year in a row that Alzheimer's disease care will cost more than $250 billion, trillion with a T, $290 billion this year. We do expect that as the prevalence of the disease increases, of course, the cost is also going to increase, so that by 2050, in the year 2050, that cost will be over $1 trillion. We simply can't support that. Two-thirds of that is from Medicare and Medicaid. So we're all on the hook from that, you know, whether we have someone in our immediate family with Alzheimer's or not.
Dr. Forgo, you said unless there is a medical breakthrough, and I also said in the introduction that much of what we know about Alzheimer's disease has only been discovered in the past three decades or so. For many of us, as observers, it appears as though we're not really making a lot of advancement. And when we talk about these numbers that are truly frightening, what also is frightening about it is that there is no cure. And the question arises, is there a way to, number one, prevent Alzheimer's disease? Number two, to treat it? Early diagnosis, all those questions. But where are we right now as far as the research goes?
Yeah, great question. There's a lot there. I'll try to just focus on.
I know. There's about five questions right
there. That's
all
good. I'll try to focus on just a couple of things, though. If you're just sort of listening to the news or watching the news and kind of, you know, seeing, what's happening there, it can be easy to think that there's not a lot of activity in Alzheimer's and dementia research. But the reality is that we're living in a golden age of Alzheimer's research. There is more excitement and optimism in the research community today around Alzheimer's than there ever has been before. Breakthroughs are happening frequently. Now, it's a matter of getting those breakthroughs out of the laboratory and into the physician's office. And for that, you need clinical trials, which is part of why we are so invested in making it easier for people to participate in those clinical trials.
Yeah, Matt, you are one of your key responsibilities with the Alzheimer's Association is a trial match. Explain what that is.
Sure. Well, there are about 300 clinical trials in the U.S. happening today around Alzheimer's. Actually, 42 that are phase 3 trials. So a lot happening. But it can be difficult to find those clinical trials. And so their information about them is kind of spread all over the internet. You have to, read and understand some of the medical jargon to find out if you're even eligible. So we've created a free, easy-to-use tool called Trial Match. You can find it at alz.org/trialmatch, with Trial Match being all one word. Or you can just call our 800 number, 800-272-3900, and we can connect you with someone that can help you sign up for Trial Match. What Trial Match does is it lowers the barrier to learning about clinical trials. Signing up for Trial Match, I want to be very clear, does not sign you up to be in a clinical trial. But if you answer a few questions for us, how old are you? Where do you live? Do you take any medications, et cetera, we can use that information and compare it to what are called the eligibility criteria, right? So what you have to sort of be like in order to make it into a clinical trial. We compare it to those eligibility criteria for all 300 studies, and then we give you a customized list. Here are the 5 or 10 that it looks like you might be a good fit for. We put them in plain English, and then if you're interested in any of those, you also get the name and telephone number of the person to reach out to find out more and potentially volunteer.
When you said that, there were a couple of things I wanted to ask you about, but when you said that the challenge is getting it from the research lab to the physician's office, we know that medications, for example, have to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration. That process can often take a long time, but considering the urgency of where we are now, will that move any faster with some of the medications, some of the treatments that are being discovered as part of these clinical trials?
Well, the FDA, first of all, let me say that it's as it should be that medications have to be approved by the FDA, because you have to find out not only are they really going to work, but are they safe? And we've seen situations before where medications have come across that have turned out not to be very safe. And so so the FDA process is one that absolutely is critical for protecting the populace from bad medications. That being said, I do want to give the FDA kudos and credit that they've been very flexible in terms of working with the scientific community around Alzheimer's disease to give a path forward to have medications that are beneficial to be approved in a less cumbersome fashion. So they've actually been quite good about that. A lot of what's going to get us where we need to get more quickly, though, is increasing the size of the pipeline. So some of it's about speeding up how things travel through the pipeline, and some of it's about making sure you have more in that pipeline. And that's where the increased research funding that we've seen recently has been very helpful.
Clay, what were you going to say?
Well, and I was going to say, as Dr. Farrow touches on that increase in research funding, it's actually a great example of how local communities, grassroots supports, elected officials, and the federal government have made a change, right? For 30 years, we had seen research funding for dementia essentially flat, if not down when you consider inflation. And in 2011, at $400-some million dollars a year, right, which is a large sum, but is not nearly the amount needed to increase those shots on goal.
Okay, $400 million from who?
From the at NIH for dementia-focused research.
That doesn't sound like a lot of money.
It doesn't, right? And in fact, scientists at the time at NIH looked at the idea that it would take $2 billion annually to begin to really look at something that would effectively treat, prevent, or cure this disease, and trying to get to that marker. And knowing we've seen success in other disease states, when we invest in research, we see advancement. And so that's 2011. Here we are in 2019, and we can be incredibly proud and excited as we talk about increasing access, is that that number has increased to $2.3 billion, essentially almost quintupling through the work of elected officials, advocates, the federal government, advocacy from the National Institute of Health, all of that coming together to address this at the pace and at the scope of the crisis it is.
Dr. Fargo, you mentioned that there have been breakthroughs. Give me some specific examples. What kind of breakthroughs have we made?
Sure. So some of those are in the way that we understand Alzheimer's disease. So it hasn't been too long ago that Alzheimer's disease could not be identified until a person had dementia. And if I may take a step back and describe dementia versus Alzheimer's disease, because that confuses a lot of people as well. Dementia is basically the set of symptoms that a person experiences when they have Alzheimer's disease. And if your listeners have had this in their family, you know, they know what I'm talking about here. It's a decrease in a person's cognitive ability, memory, thinking, judgment, decision making, that becomes so pronounced that it interferes with a person's ability to take care of themselves, get dressed, take their medication, et cetera. When the brain disease Alzheimer's has gotten that bad, that's called dementia. There are other causes of dementia too, but for now we can restrict, you know, to Alzheimer's for this conversation. So you used to not even be able to know if someone had Alzheimer's until they had that, you know, frank dementia. But of course, Alzheimer's doesn't start when a person has dementia. What we have found out in the past few years is that Alzheimer's disease actually starts in the brain 20 years before those dementia symptoms set in. Now, the reason that is an important breakthrough is because that is a window that we now have to intervene to potentially stop people from developing those dementia symptoms. To explain what I mean there, we're all familiar with heart disease, right? And with heart disease, it doesn't start with your first heart attack. It starts decades before, as you have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, et cetera. The difference being that with heart disease, we now have medications that we can give you to stop that heart attack from happening, because we can lower your cholesterol, we can lower your blood pressure, et cetera. Now, this breakthrough of understanding Alzheimer's as being this long-term, slowly developing disease has allowed the clinical trials to now focus on medications that would look very similar to what they do in heart disease. In other words, they would stop or slow the progression of the disease before it ever turns into dementia symptoms.
And I have to watch how I ask this question. I was about to say there is a relationship between heart disease and Alzheimer's disease. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but many of the same factors that lead to heart disease, the research has found, also leads to dementia and Alzheimer's disease, and also may be a way of preventing Alzheimer's disease, correct?
That's exactly right. And so there are things that people can do today that will lower their risk of cognitive decline as they age and potentially lower their risk for developing outright dementia. And many of those things do look like the exact same kinds of things that you would do to protect your heart health. The brain, even though it's a relatively small organ in the body compared to things like, you know, the skin or your lungs, actually is very hungry for oxygen. It's very hungry for nutrients. Your brain is like a Maserati engine. It's firing all the time. Yeah, very active. And with that engine, you got to give it lots of gasoline. And with your brain, you have to give it lots of blood, which is carrying all the oxygen and those other nutrients. So anything that compromises the blood vessels in your brain slows down, you know, the transfer of those nutrients and oxygen to the brain tissue, which harms your brain. And so ultimately, a lot of dementia is caused actually by the problems with the blood vessels in the brain. So the best things that people can do today to reduce their risk are exercising regularly, making sure they're making healthy eating choices. If they have high blood pressure, absolutely get that treated. We know that that's one of the most important things a person can do to reduce their risk for dementia. So there are good things that people can do right now.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional.
Welcome back
Lamar.
To Smart Talk.
Check out some of the upcoming topics for Smart Talk at WITF.org/smarttalk. Some of the shows we're working on: high prescription drug cost, affordable housing, and also looking at autism. It's Autism Awareness Month, and this Friday we'll be talking about that. You can share your questions ahead of time by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about Alzheimer's disease and research and advances, clinical trials, a lot of different topics having to do with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Our guest today, Clay Jacobs, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association Greater Pennsylvania Chapter. Dr. Keith Fargos, the Director of Scientific Programs and Outreach at the Alzheimer's Association. That's the national level, and Dr. Fargo is here in central Pennsylvania to speak at a couple of locations. We welcome your questions and comments. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at @smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Faith in Lancaster Township. Faith, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I have three, and I'll make it quick, questions, and then I'll hang up so the gentleman can answer.
All right.
Number one, why is it so difficult to come up with prevention, treatment, and a cure? One of the gentlemen said that this is a great time because of funds, but haven't some of the major pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer, and I believe there was another one, pulled out because of failures? That's the first question. The second is this. Is there any synergy among all the researchers on Alzheimer's and dementia besides the Alzheimer's Association? Are there other, and I know there are other independents, but is there any synergy? And the third one is this. It's a very small subset, fortunately, but the opioid addicts, should they not die and recover? and continue on into their middle and old years, would they be more likely to develop Alzheimer's or dementia? So I'll hang up.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Faith, you have three very good questions. Let's take them one at a time. She said that it seems as though pharmaceutical companies holding up some research. What about that?
Yeah, so the question, I think, was why is it so difficult to develop effective medications for Alzheimer's and other dementias? And some of that, you know, is due to limited understanding of the disease, which has now changed. And so if you were to go back 10 years ago and say, you know, where are we with clinical trials? The answer was we weren't very far. But now that we have a better understanding of the disease, how it develops, the time frame in which it develops, when we should be targeting the disease in terms of medication development, things are actually progressing fairly rapidly today. And so, yes, we have seen the occasional pharmaceutical company decide that, you know, they don't want to be in this fight anymore. Usually, though, that says more about their particular drug pipeline than it does about this disease. There are most of the major pharmaceutical companies are absolutely still in this fight, as they should be.
Can I interrupt for just one second? Because
yes.
The visual of that, of a major pharmaceutical company saying that we're pulling out from clinical trials or Alzheimer's research may say to some people that they're not optimistic about finding a medication or finding something. Because let's face it, they're in the business to make money. Someone who could find that drug, and I'm not going to call it a miracle drug, but that medication that could cure Alzheimer's or really progress in the treatment, I mean, there's a lot of money to be made there. So you understand what I'm saying. When someone pulls out, the visual of it is they're not really optimistic.
No, that's absolutely true. For every company that has left Alzheimer's disease research, though, there are a lot of companies who have jumped in. Sometimes those are the smaller companies that aren't yet household names. Sometimes it's the larger companies who are developing a pipeline of potential medications. So any clinical trial costs an enormous amount of money. A phase three clinical trial, which is the final phase of drug development, for Alzheimer's disease will cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And a company will only invest hundreds of millions of dollars in one of these trials if they feel like a medication that they have the rights to has a good chance of succeeding. So if a company pulls out of any area of research, not just Alzheimer's disease, this happens in all areas of research, it really just means that their own portfolio of medications that they own the rights to, they're not confident in those particular medications. Not that they're not confident that the disease cannot be attacked.
Okay.
So again, it says less about Alzheimer's and more about that company's portfolio of medications that they own the rights to. The other thing is,
she asked about synergy between researchers.
Yeah, she did. Okay, thank you. So, absolutely, in Alzheimer's disease research is actually one of the most collegial areas of research. The researchers in Alzheimer's work together not only in the U.S., but actually all across the globe. In the United States, that is highlighted primarily by something called the Alzheimer's Disease Research Centers. This is the NIH program that funds various centers of excellence across the country. There are about 30 of them, and those have really grown up at the same time that Alzheimer's research has, really over the past 30 to 40 years. And so you have a cadre of researchers that all know each other very well and work together very frequently. On an international level, that kind of collaboration is really driven by the Alzheimer's Association. We have an international conference that we put on every year for scientists. 6,000 researchers from 70 countries come to that. We have a scientific society for researchers called iSTART. This has 4,500 members from, again, about 70 different countries. So a very collegial area of research, actually.
Mm-hmm. We're going to say,
Glenn. Well, and I think to that, too, two important pieces of context as we have this discussion is we've talked quite a bit about treatment and obviously the bench science and some of that work going on, but we talk about research holistically. It is also around things like lifestyle. It is around care and support best practices. It is about finding a cure, but also there are things we can do, evidence-based interventions on how do we improve care? How do we improve someone's experience by providing access to certain things after diagnosis? How, dealing within a public health issue, how do we increase actual screening and identification or differential diagnosis of this disease? That field is broad. And so all of this work, seeing some of these things move forward, is exciting, right? As we talk about it, or if we talk to families, it's not quick enough, but we are seeing that ramp up Dr. Fargo mentioned. And I think to that first point about barriers too, it goes back to our earlier conversation about clinical trial enrollment, is that is one of the barriers that, that warrants us circling back to, is having individuals, families, communities that are interested in participating in research, especially in an age where the access to trials is drastically increasing, is really important, so that we're not waiting for people to help prove and move the work forward. And so there are ways like Trial Match and other that people can become involved, become aware of what's available to them. And I think it really is a disease that's going to take communities and individuals taking part in clinical trials and other other ways to mobilize that community to make a difference.
Our third question that Faith had, and this is a good one too, having to do with the opioid crisis right now. She asked if those who have been dependent on opioids are more susceptible to dementia and Alzheimer's. I'm going to follow up with the second part of that question. And with the focus on the opioid crisis, has that taken resources away from research on Alzheimer's?
So I'll start with the second piece, which is not to my knowledge. I don't think it's, you know, a wise idea to sort of get into, you know, kind of disease wars,
right,
if you
right.
will, right? certainly the opioid crisis is enormous and worthy of resources to get that under control and save lives, frankly. Similarly, Alzheimer's is an enormous problem and needs resources to save lives there. And I think that we can all be happy about the fact that we have stepped up as a nation really on both fronts, and so that's good news. In terms of the what the current crisis with opioids means for Alzheimer's and dementia later, we simply don't know yet. I mean, we're really too early into this, you know, experience with opioids being so widespread to know what's going to happen 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now. We just don't know what's going to happen with many of these people who are young or middle-aged. Now, what happens with them when they get older? We'll have to monitor that, but we really don't know what to expect.
But I want to kind of follow up on that in that everyone looks for a cause, and there are a number of things that have to be in place for someone to develop dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Head trauma, though, is one that kind of can be unforeseen, in that people who have had traumatic head injuries often, maybe I shouldn't say often, but can develop a dementia and Alzheimer's disease, correct?
That is correct. They're more likely to. And so a person who has had a very serious traumatic brain injury, which would be, you know, they've been unconscious for more than a day, okay, that person is at higher risk for developing dementia later in life, or a person who has had multiple mild traumatic brain injuries, which can be as,
like, you know, concussions.
Yeah, just sort of, you know, they might call it getting your bell rung, right, in football. If that's happened to you multiple times for any reason, whether it's football or boxing or, you know, whatever, then that person is also at higher risk. You know, one of the things that people can do to reduce their risk is wear your helmet, okay? Don't drive recklessly, right? Most brain injuries in this country are actually caused by driving, automobile accidents. Also, when a person begins to get older, and if they have trouble sort of getting around the house without falling, that's a major concern. And so that's a time point where, you know, as a family member, you know, you want to help your older relatives think through, you know, how they can sort of change things around in their house to reduce the risk of falling, because falls can lead to head injuries in older folks, which can precipitate dementia.
What about genetics?
Genetics play a role, but not as large as most people expect that they do. Certainly Alzheimer's does run in families in the sense that if you have a first-degree relative with Alzheimer's disease, you are at an increased risk for also developing Alzheimer's, but it's not a sure thing. And similarly, everyone with a brain is at risk. I mean, this is a disease that is enormously prevalent in the general population. If you take a look at people who are over the age of 85, it's 1 in 3. So whether there's someone in your family or not, you essentially have a 1 in 3 chance of developing this disease if you're lucky enough to live to 85.
Let's take another phone call from Sue in Elizabeth Township. Sue, you're on the air.
Hello. I've read that high levels of cortisol may contribute to developing Alzheimer's and that smiling or laughing might help to lower the levels of cortisol. And I've found for myself that at night, if I am wakeful because I'm worrying, if I smile and do silent chuckles to myself, that sounds weird, I know, but then I count them over and over to 100, I get to sleep. And when stressed during the day, I do that smile and chuckle. I mean, it sounds weird, I know, but it relaxes me. So, okay, thanks.
Can I chuckle?
Pardon?
Can I chuckle?
Can you chuckle?
Yeah, can I?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. That sounds simple. And as she said a couple times, it sounds weird. Anything to it?
Well, I mean, certainly we know that stress does play a role. And so people that have led especially very, very high stress lives are at an increased risk for dementia. So usually you measure that kind of and the reason we're talking about stress here is because she mentioned cortisol. And cortisol is something that you can measure in the blood that typically tells you something about a person's stress level. But if you're talking about things like people who have been in combat, who have gone through a divorce, who have had a child pass away, all of these things that we would all agree are stressful life experiences, the more of those stressful life experiences you have had, the higher your risk for developing dementia later in life. And so I think certainly things that we can do to reduce our stress levels, it can't be bad.
What about alcoholism?
Alcoholism is a problem as well. There is a specific kind of dementia called Korsakoff's dementia, which is caused by long-term alcohol abuse. And so people do need to, be careful with that. And the research is showing that if any level of alcohol is okay for your health, and that's in question. Some studies are showing, none. You shouldn't have any alcohol, and any is going to cause you health problems. Others would say maybe in moderation, 1 to 2 drinks, okay, is probably okay according to some studies. All the research, though, would suggest that drinking to excess or drinking regularly is very detrimental to your health, including your cardiovascular system, including your brain, and all of those things would put you at higher risk for dementia.
Dr. Fargo, you mentioned earlier some of the things that we have discovered over the last 20 years in that 20 years that it takes 20 years for or can take 20 years, up to 20 years for Alzheimer's to develop. So, and one of the questions that always comes in my mind when I think about this is, do people really want to know because of where we are, knowing that it is a disease that could be fatal, 1 in 6 people dying from it nowadays, and that the treatments may slow it down, may not slow it down. So with all that said, do you advise people to try to get, I don't know if I'd say diagnosis or, but to go to find out whether they are susceptible to Alzheimer's disease. And if they find they are, what can be done?
The answer is 100% yes. We think that this is one of the most important things a person can do for their cognitive health is to make sure that they're talking to their physician about their thinking and memory on a regular basis, especially as they start to get older. One of the things that we've had since the Affordable Care Act in Medicare is called the annual wellness visit, AWV. Every senior has a right to an annual wellness visit every year. That annual wellness visit is supposed to include an assessment of a person's cognition, their thinking and memory abilities. We're finding that that doesn't happen in many cases. Either the physician is waiting for, frank symptoms to show up, or the patient themselves doesn't want to think about this or talk about it. But we know that if the patient brings it up, virtually every time the physician will do it. And so we urge you that as you're going to see your doctor for your annual wellness visit, just ask, hey, doc, do we need to check my thinking and memory? The reason that you want to do that is twofold, really. Number one, it might not be dementia. You could have some problems with your thinking and memory that are treatable. Things like sleep apnea, things like depression, things like vitamin deficiencies. And if you don't find that out, you're going to be living with cognitive impairment for no reason. Okay. Secondly, let's say you find out that it is Alzheimer's disease. No one wants that news, right? You mentioned the medications today don't stop the disease, but the medications of the future will. And the first person who ever has one of these medications that stops Alzheimer's disease will do so in the context of a clinical trial. And the only way you can get in a clinical trial for that kind of medication is if you know you have the disease.
Mm. We're almost out of time. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. What kind of advice or what kind of information would you leave with our audience today? Kind of summarize.
I think if anything we said resonated or if there are additional questions, it's to know that you're not alone, that there are answers, that there is more information. And folks can reach out to us at our 24/7 helpline at 800-272-3900. They can visit ALZ.org to find out more information. But again, if there is anything that connects with or anything that is left, there's so much to talk about. Reach out and we will be able to support you in however we can.
And a quick question here from a listener. I wanted to know, there are people who say when you are with someone who has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and I don't know how many stages there are, that, they may not recognize you, but they know you're there. True?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what's happening in a person's mind, but definitely the thing to remember is that a person with Alzheimer's, first and foremost, is a person. And so the kinds of things that you would want for yourself as an individual, we can safely guess are the kinds of things that people, even in the most severe stages, also want for themselves.
Dr. Keith Fargo is Director of Scientific Programs and Outreach at the Alzheimer's Association. Clay Jacobs is the Executive Director, Alzheimer's Association, Greater PA Chapter. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you again.
Thanks.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen tomorrow for Smart Talk when we discuss affordable housing. It's becoming a real issue, especially at certain pockets of Pennsylvania, but we'll be talking about affordable housing. You can visit our website to get an outlook of the conversations we're working on, plus leave a voicemail or a voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs, including tomorrow. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. Larry Harold of Sunbury is a senior history and religious studies major at Susquehanna University. He's been awarded the prestigious Fulbright U.S. Student Program Award for the 2019-2020 academic year from the U.S. Department of State and the J. William Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board. Larry Harold will pursue his master's degree at the University of Kent in Canterbury in the United Kingdom, researching the archives of Geoffrey Amherst, 1st Baron Amherst, who was the Commander-in-Chief of the British Army during the American Revolutionary War. Larry Harold, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. First of all, congratulations. This is a prestigious award. Just tell me your thoughts when you got this award.
Yeah, it really didn't sink in immediately. I was kind of in a state of shock. I had to read the email a few times. And I was with a great group of people, and there was so much excitement, and I was kind of standing there in shock. But it is such a prestigious award, and it's an honor, really, to be the recipient of it. And it will just present me with so much opportunity, and I'm so thankful for all of the help that I got in the application process, especially from faculty and my family and friends.
When you say it presents you with so much opportunity, like in what ways?
So Fulbright has a great networking community. There's a long history of people who have received the award who have gone on to do really extraordinary things. And, you know, at a more practical level, like Susquehanna University has several people who have been the recipients of Fulbrights. So to be able to work with them at universities as I'm studying will really help me to make connections as I go out into the job field and pursue whatever interests I have.
Your interests are history and religious studies. Tell me about that and how you became interested and what you want to do.
Right. So I really fell in love with history in seventh grade. So quite a while ago, I had a phenomenal teacher. And that kind of grew and changed just as everyone's interests change. I started out really liking ancient history. And then when I got to Susquehanna, I took more classes in the modern era, more American history. And I became interested specifically in religious identity. So I added religious studies as a second major. And so my work on loyalists, which was my senior—
In the Revolution?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's my senior research. And I looked particularly at Anglicans and Quakers, so kind of bringing religious identity into examining these loyalists and what their experiences were like.
Our audience is very much interested in history, and I'm sure they would be interested in your research. What did you find about the loyalists, and specifically with Quakers and Anglicans?
Yeah, so I found throughout my education that the loyalists are not frequently talked about, and that might just be our own historical—
Or if they are, they're vilified.
Yeah, it might be our historical bias. And really, they were just ordinary citizens, like the people who were in favor of independence, and really the evidence bears that a majority of people didn't really hold a strong opinion during the Revolutionary War. So what I found was that the most prominent loyalists, or those who had the strongest convictions in their pro-British identity, were typically Quakers who were pacifist. They were opposed to the war in general, and so they thought that maintaining the status quo with Britain would be a more viable option and fell more in line with their personal beliefs. And Anglicans are members of the Church of England, and so they have a strong religious tie to Great Britain. And so what ended up happening to them was if they were open about their political convictions, they often faced a variety of persecutions. Sometimes it came from their neighbors. So there's records of people throwing rocks through windows, harassing people in the streets. And sometimes it would come from the government. So people would quite frequently be arrested or have their property confiscated. Just a variety of measures throughout the war that were more intense in Pennsylvania, because this was— What I've seen and what the scholarship backs up is that Pennsylvania was one of the most diverse and also one of the strong political, a strong political center during the war with Philadelphia.
A lot of people would find it interesting that when you said that most people didn't really have an opinion, because I think that there are many of us who have this picture of fire-breathing patriots, or, as I said, loyalists, who are often portrayed as villains throughout it. But you, from your research and from what you know, most people didn't really care.
So a large percentage of the population was illiterate, so they would not have been reading a lot of the political treaties that were being written by the most fervent patriots or by the established loyalist politicians in the colony. So not being able to read that and being faced with the practical realities of life, Pennsylvania was largely frontier. Once you moved away from Philadelphia, people were farming, and really it was about just getting by and making a living. So to really be politically involved was a privilege that often was reserved for the elites in the colonies. So, yeah, a lot of people did not necessarily hold strong convictions, and they became the victims of the violence that eventually spread out through the colony during the war.
As part of your Fulbright, you will be studying for your master's degree at the University of Kent in Canterbury in Britain. Researching the archives of Geoffrey Amherst, the first Baron Amherst, who was the Commander-in-Chief of the British Army during the American Revolutionary War. I have to say that Geoffrey Amherst is probably not a name that is familiar to most Americans who have even studied the American Revolution, because we know the Howes, the British commanders here in the colonies. But Geoffrey Amherst, tell me a little bit about him and why you decided to study that.
Right. So his name in the colonies is a little more well known for his role in the French and Indian War. So he was a British general at that time. He was the governor of Virginia around that same time period. And what happened was he rose through the ranks back in the United Kingdom then to become the commander-in-chief of the armed forces in Britain, and that got him a seat on the British cabinet during the war. So he was managing things from afar. He would have been in communication with General Howe and General Cornwallis and really making these upper-level decisions. And so I was interested in him because what I'm ultimately trying to see is if the Loyalist population could be classified as a refugee population. I talked about the violence that spread out after the British had entered Philadelphia, the harassment that Loyalists faced getting evicted from their homes, and so many of them had to flee to Canada or to the United Kingdom or elsewhere in the British Empire. And he, because of his position in the cabinet as the head of the British military, he would have been receiving this correspondence. He would have had to look at these reports of Loyalists, at times 4,000 people on a single ship, being transferred up into Canada from New York City as the American army was approaching. So that's where really where my interest in him got started, was because there's not a lot that's known about him during the Revolution. And I really think that his manuscript collection, which is in the Kent County Archives, could really yield some interesting pieces of information on how a government so far removed from the conflict is trying to grapple with a refugee population.
See, this is something that I find fascinating, too, that obviously we don't have the communications tools that we have even 100 years later. And, you know, it would take months to get information from England to the colonies itself. And, you know, it sounds interesting that you're trying to manage a war. Of course, it wasn't just a war in the New World, in the colonies. It was going on, kind of a world war, if you will, that the United Kingdom was involved with. But to try to manage a war from thousands of miles away.
Yeah, absolutely. So the UK was also at war with France and Spain for a shorter period of time. And so this was a war that really took place all around the world. It took place in the Caribbean and Europe. In India to an extent. So yes, he would have been dealing with conflicts worldwide, and that's why looking at his manuscripts could yield some really personal insights into how the government might have been dealing with this, because the conflicts we think of, I think especially military conflicts, wars, we think of like the big picture. But in every community that this conflict is affecting, you have very personal stories, and people are forced out of the area. Their livelihoods are destroyed, and sometimes we lose track of what happened to them. So what I think it's important to track is how this could be an early example of how a government so far removed that's fighting this really large-scale conflict is also trying to manage something that's very real and tangible for ordinary people, people who weren't necessarily motivated by the politics, but their lives were really destroyed. They had to start over, and the only people they could turn to are people thousands of miles away in London.
Now, this is for your master's degree, but what do you hope to do with this information? Is there a book in the future? Is there teaching? What are your career aspirations?
So I'd really like to, so I want to continue this research from my bachelor's into this master's program, and then I would definitely consider going into a PhD program and continuing the same research. I think when we look at the refugee crises that are happening all around the world, I think this is a topic worth examining, looking at how these wars that we are used to thinking in very traditional ways could be reconceptualized to see what ordinary people were going through, to see how it could relate to conflicts today. And so I think that's worth pursuing in a PhD program, and I would like to go on to be a history professor and really look at refugee studies. Mm.
And the point you make is so important, that when people look at history and what happened in history and think, okay, that happened 200 years ago, it's kind of short-sighted, that a lot of what happened 200, 250 years ago, we're dealing with some of the same issues today. But Larry Harrold, I want to say congratulations again to you. By the way, would you have had the opportunity if you had not gotten this Fulbright scholarship?
It would have been significantly more difficult with lots of loans involved, and I definitely would not have the networking connections that will come about with it. So I'm very thankful to Fulbright and to all the help that I've gotten along the way. It's made things tremendously. That's just a great opportunity.
Larry Harrold is from Sunbury. He's a senior history and religious studies major at Susquehanna University, a recipient of the prestigious Fulbright scholarship. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about affordable housing. That's on tomorrow's Smart Talk.